Imagine trying to march an invading army, but you're forced to walk single file on a 3,000-foot mountain ridge.
Because the valley below you will literally swallow your troops whole.
Exactly. One wrong step, and you're dealing with a sheer drop. Welcome to the ancient world. It is, well, it's a completely different reality than the flat, color-coded maps we're so used to looking at today.
Right, where you just draw a straight line from point A to point B.
Yeah. It doesn't work like that.
No, you really have to picture the physics of it. When you strip away modern highways and tunnels and bridges, the ancient landscape was, I mean, it was the absolute definition of a topographical obstacle course.
A total nightmare for travel.
Exactly. Reading ancient historical texts without understanding that physical geography is genuinely like watching a play without seeing the stage. The script only makes sense when you know where the walls are.
That is such a great way to put it.
Yeah.
So welcome to today's deep dive. Our mission for you listening is to decode that very stage, the physical landscape of the ancient world.
And we've got some incredible source material for this.
We do. We are pulling from a fascinating historical geography lecture by Dr. Perry Phillips. And he focuses specifically on a region known as the Hill Country of Israel. So we aren't just, you know, tracing lines on parchment today.
No, not at all.
We're discovering how dirt, hard limestone, and sheer elevation literally shaped empires, how they dictated trade routes and decided the outcomes of ancient wars.
To really grasp the scale of this, you have to picture the entire Middle East in your mind. Israel is, well, it's the ultimate land between.
The land between, right?
Yeah, it's squeezed geographically between the Mediterranean Sea to the west and this massive, completely impassable Arabian desert to the east. So it's a remarkably narrow strip of habitable land.
Basically a literal pressure cooker.
Oh, absolutely. And the pressure isn't just geographic, it's geopolitical. You have these massive, hungry superpowers in Mesopotamia to the north, like the Assyrians and the Babylonians.
Right.
And then you have the ancient powerhouse of Egypt to the south. So anyone who wanted to trade, conquer, or even just communicate between those two massive spheres of influence, they had to walk right through this tiny corridor.
And it's worth noting for you as a listener, before we get too deep into this, Dr. Phillips uses figures you've probably heard of from ancient texts. People like King David, Joshua, Jesus.
Right. They pop up a lot in the lecture.
Yeah. But he's not doing that to make a theological point. And we aren't either. We are simply reporting on the geography as it's presented in the lecture, using these ancient texts to help us track who was moving through this incredibly rugged dirt and rock.
Right, because using the historical record anchors the geography for us. We can see exactly how people navigated this squeezed land between by zooming in on the central spine of the region.
Okay.
There are five main topographical zones here, but our focus today is that central dominating feature, which is the hill country.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because everything in the hill country starts with the literal bedrock, right?
Yeah.
Which is hard limestone.
Very hard. Fortress-level durability, really.
Yeah. But here is the secret to this rock. When it finally does break down and erode over centuries, it creates this incredibly rich red soil.
Which is vital.
Vital. Plus, the structure of the limestone allows groundwater to bubble up naturally as springs down in the deep valleys. The ancient texts like Deuteronomy actually brag about this topography. They praise the good soil, the deep valleys, and the reliable springs.
And that combination of rich red soil and reliable spring water, I mean, that is the baseline for human survival in the region. But getting to those resources, that's the problem.
Because the topography is just so severe.
It really is. We are talking about jagged, exposed ridges and incredibly deep plunging valleys that just drop out from under you.
The source actually describes this really striking phenomenon of natural terracing. Because of the way the hard limestone breaks down horizontally over time, the hillsides literally look like giant steps.
Like a titan carved them out.
Yes. It sounds almost like a real-life Minecraft landscape, you know, just blocky, staggered steps going up the mountainside. But here is what I want to clarify, and I think a lot of people wonder this.
Okay, what's that?
If you have these deep, narrow valleys with water springs pooling at the bottom, why wouldn't ancient people just travel through the valleys?
Right. It seems safer.
Yeah. It seems like it would be a highly protected way to move without being seen by enemies, rather than, you know, walking way up on the exposed mountain ridges.
Well, the valleys seem like a good idea until you actually look at the physical reality on the ground. These aren't gently sloping meadows. They are wadis.
Wadis.
Right. Steep, highly unpredictable ravines. They are treacherously narrow, and they are prone to sudden, violent flash floods.
Oh, wow. So you could just be washed away.
Exactly. And even when they're totally dry, they are utterly choked with massive boulders and debris that have fallen from those limestone steps.
Sounds like a nightmare to walk through.
It is. If you march an army or lead a heavily loaded trade caravan down into a wadi, you are basically a sitting duck. You can't maneuver, you can't see over the next bend, and you are highly vulnerable to ambush from above.
So the valleys are a literal death trap. You are forced up onto the ridges.
Exactly. You stay high because it is the only continuous, reliable path. Ancient roads had to follow the continuous mountain ridges. And what's fascinating here is how human ingenuity worked with this severe geology just to secure a food supply.
Right, because of those Minecraft steps.
Yeah, those natural steps were really only a starting point. Ancient farmers realized they had to enhance that terracing if they wanted to plant anything.
And the labor involved is staggering. I mean, they undertook the backbreaking work of digging the loose rocks out of that rich red soil by hand.
Hand by hand.
Yeah, they would carry those rocks to the edge of the natural limestone terrace and meticulously build these retaining walls.
And retaining walls are everything in this landscape. Without them, the first heavy rain would wash all that vital, nutrient-rich red soil right over the edge and down into those impassable wadis.
Which would ruin everything.
Completely. So by locking the soil in place with stone walls, they flattened the steps. And on those reinforced terraces, they planted olive trees, grapevines, pomegranates. They quite literally sculpted the mountainside to guarantee their survival.
And they were highly efficient, too. They didn't just toss the extra rocks down the mountain. They used them to build agricultural watchtowers right there in the middle of their terraced fields.
Which is such a great detail from the lecture.
It is. Because these weren't just like observation posts for a sunny afternoon. Farmers would literally sleep inside these stone towers overnight during harvest time.
You really had to guard your stuff.
Yeah. When you realize that an entire year's livelihood, like every olive, every grape, comes down to a few weeks of harvest, you understand why they had to sleep in the dirt to guard their crops from thieves or foraging animals.
It was a fiercely protected livelihood. And, you know, that intense need for protection brings us to the broader geopolitical reality.
How so?
Well, because survival and travel were so severely restricted to these high, narrow ridge routes, control of the region wasn't really about holding massive swaths of land. It was about controlling the intersections.
The choke points.
Right. Whoever controlled the points where those ridges met controlled the entire region. You couldn't just bypass a checkpoint by taking a valley.
Because you'd die in the wadi. So if everyone is forced to walk on top of the ridges to survive, what happens when those major ridges cross?
Well, you get the ultimate ancient choke point. I want you to picture a distinct dip in these continuous mountains on the map. It's a central area called the Hill Country of Benjamin.
The Benjamin Plateau.
Exactly. Benjamin is a plateau situated between two much higher, significantly more rugged elevations. To the south, you have the mountains of Jita reaching up around 3,000 feet. And to the north, the mountains of Ephraim are just as towering and rugged.
So Benjamin is like a geographical dip, a saddle point, as the source calls it. And for you listening, here is why this specific saddle changes everything.
It's all about the elevation.
Right. Because it's flatter and lower in elevation, Benjamin is the one and only place where that primary north-south ridge route perfectly intersects with the major east-west route.
And that east-west road is crucial. It connects the Transjordan region across the Jordan River to the east, all the way to the Mediterranean coast in the west.
It's the crossroads of the ancient world.
It really is. Think about the logistics of moving a trade caravan loaded with goods, or an army with chariots and supplies. You need flatter ground. If you want to move across the region, you have to pass through the Benjamin Plateau. It operates as a mandatory toll booth.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The source gives us a brilliant front row seat to the political drama this specific intersection caused.
Oh, the Rama situation.
Yes. So after the ancient kingdom split into north and south, you had the northern king, Baasha, and the southern king, Asa, who ruled from Jerusalem. Baasha marches his forces south and fortifies a city called Rama.
And why Rama?
Because it sat directly on this exact crossroad in the Benjamin Saddle.
It was a strategic masterstroke by Baasha. By putting a military fortress right on that intersection, he effectively placed a massive boulder on the only highway. He entirely cut off the northern approach for King Asa.
And because of the valleys we just talked about, Issa can't just send his troops around the fortress. He is totally boxed in. His capital, Jerusalem, is economically choked off from trade and militarily vulnerable.
And Issa's response perfectly illustrates how geography dictates military tactics. I mean, Issa is at a severe topographical disadvantage here.
You can't just attack.
No, he can't march his army up the narrow ridge to fight a heavily fortified Ramah head-on. It would be an absolute slaughter. So he has to use asymmetric warfare. Asa gathers his wealth and hires Syrian kings from far to the north to attack Baasha's northern flank.
It's a brilliant distraction. Baasha realizes his home territory is under attack, panics, and completely abandons his brand new fortress at Ramah to go defend his northern borders. He just leaves the crossroads wide open.
And Asa sweeps in immediately. But he doesn't just occupy Baasha's fort.
This is my favorite part.
He literally dismantles Ramah's fortifications, stone by stone. He hauls all those building materials away and uses them to build up his own city, Mizpah, just a bit further off.
So he permanently secures his own access to that crossroad. He stole his enemy's barricade to build his own castle, ensuring he would never be boxed in on that ridge again.
It perfectly illustrates the desperation of navigating this terrain. And, you know, even within that Benjamin saddle, there are pockets of extreme danger. The eastern edge of Benjamin, dropping down toward the Dead Sea, is incredibly rugged. The source details a sheer ridge at a place called Wadi Mukmas.
Oh, the cliff face.
Yeah, Wadi Mukmas is a textbook example of those deep, treacherous ravines we discussed earlier. It is literally a sheer vertical cliff face.
Hmm. Which makes the story of Jonathan and his armor-bearer so incredible. The ancient texts record them scaling this vertical cliff at Wadi Mukmas to successfully ambush a Philistine garrison stationed at the top.
Free climbing a cliff in ancient armor.
Right. When you look at photos of this specific wadi, it is just a wall of rock. It proves that conventional travel was so restricted by the ridges that free climbing a cliff was actually considered a viable military tactic.
The element of surprise was total, because no rational army would approach from the wadi.
No way.
Now, this intense focus on the Benjamin crossroads highlights how localized and restricted movement was. But what happens when you leave that central bottleneck?
You enter totally different worlds.
Exactly. If we travel away from this intersection, either north or south, we encounter two entirely different topographical realities. And those realities completely dictated the destinies of the people living in them.
So let's start by heading south from the crossroads, down into the Judean hill country.
Judah is essentially an isolated fortress. We mentioned it rises to about 3,000 feet. It is incredibly rugged, and because of the deep intersecting wadis, it is culturally and economically cut off from the major international trade routes happening on the coast.
It's just too hard to get to.
Right. The lecture points out key cities here, like Hebron, which was King David's first capital before he moved to Jerusalem,
mm-hmm.
and a much smaller town called Tekoa.
Tekoa is a brilliant example of Judah's isolation. It sits right on the edge of the Judean wilderness. It is utterly desolate. It was the hometown of the prophet Amos, but from a strategic standpoint, it was the perfect hiding place.
Because of the terrain?
Yeah. When David was fleeing for his life from King Saul, he disappeared into this exact rugged wilderness. You can't easily march a large, organized military force into a maze of high ridges and deep valleys to find a single fugitive.
The terrain itself provided a natural defense mechanism. Judah survived for centuries, largely because it was so difficult to invade. But contrast that fortified isolation with the hill country of Manasseh to the north.
Oh, Manasseh is a completely different reality. It is much flatter, characterized by wide-open passes like the Nahal Shechem that act as natural highways leading straight out to the Mediterranean coast.
It is highly accessible.
Very. So does this mean geography actually dictated their national destinies?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, absolutely yes. Manasseh's open topography allowed for massive international commerce. They were able to easily trade with the Phoenicians.
The wealthy maritime traders to the northwest.
Exactly. Manasseh became incredibly rich because of this continuous flow of goods. But, as they say, an open door swings both ways.
Right. If a trade caravan can roll in easily, an invading army can too.
Precisely. Those wide, flat valleys that welcomed Phoenician wealth also welcomed foreign chariots. The source explicitly points out that this geographic vulnerability is the primary reason the Northern Kingdom was conquered and destroyed by the massive Assyrian Empire long before the rugged, isolated Southern Kingdom of Judah fell.
The South could hide behind its jagged 3,000-foot mountains. The North was just completely exposed. But, you know, before the Assyrians arrived, that open terrain allowed for some incredible agricultural innovation. I love this detail from the source.
The farming symbiosis.
Yes. Down to the plain of Sichar in Manasseh, the flatter ground created a unique symbiosis between the farmers and the shepherds. So after the farmers harvest their crops in the fall, they allow the local shepherds to bring their flocks of sheep directly into the harvested fields.
Which cleans up the field.
Right.
Mm.
The sheep eat the leftover stubble, cleanly clearing the field for the farmer. It's the ultimate ancient circular economy.
It really is. And the mechanism is mutually beneficial. In return for the free food, the sheep essentially pay rent in the form of manure, which heavily fertilizes the soil just in time for the next planting season.
It's brilliant.
It is a highly efficient, self-sustaining system, and it's entirely made possible by the gentler terrain of the north that allowed agriculture and large-scale shepherding to overlap.
So that open terrain brought vast wealth from trade and efficient farming. And because the north was so wealthy and open to the world, their leaders really wanted to show off. That extreme wealth completely changed how they built their cities and where they placed their capitals.
Right, but they struggled to find the right balance between showcasing their wealth and protecting it. First, the northern capital was at Shechem.
Which is deeply significant historically.
Well, very. It's located right in a valley between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, which is exactly where Joshua gathered the people to read the blessings and the curses. But structurally, Shechem was a nightmare to defend.
Because it sits right in one of those wide open valleys we just talked about.
Right.
I mean, a wealthy capital city in an open valley is a sitting duck for invaders.
So they moved the capital to a city called Tirzah, which offered slightly better protection. But by the time King Omri and his son Ahab came to power, they wanted the ultimate combination. A capital that was impenetrable, but still tightly connected to those wealthy Phoenician trade networks on the coast.
They realized they couldn't rely on the natural valleys, so they literally just bought a steep, isolated hill.
They bought the Hill of Samaria, and it was a brilliant geopolitical move. The hill was steep on all sides, making it a formidable fortress, but it was positioned so that it looked out over the western valleys that led directly to the Mediterranean Sea and their trading partners.
Once King Ahab was set up on this fortress hill, the sheer opulence of what he built is just staggering. The source details how Ahab constructed a heavily fortified palace, but the interior was adorned with carved ivory.
Just unbelievable wealth.
Yeah, archaeologists excavating the ruins of Samaria have actually found these pieces. Ivory jewelry boxes, ivory plaques, intricate ivory earrings. It was a staggering display of wealth that the prophet Amos, who remember came from the rugged, isolated wilderness of Tekoa in the south, fiercely condemned.
He called it gross idolatry and corruption.
Yeah.
Well, the geography created a stark cultural and visual contrast. You have the isolated, austere south clashing directly with the wealthy, cosmopolitan, highly decorated north.
So what does this all mean? For you listening, this highlights how ancient leaders used architecture as geopolitical propaganda. They used their geography to project power to anyone traveling those open northern roads.
They were a massive flex.
Huge. And the source provides a mind-blowing detail that proves this strategy didn't stop with Ahab. Centuries later, during the Roman period, King Herod the Great took over this exact same hill at Samaria to build a massive temple.
Herod renamed the site Sebaste, which is the Greek equivalent of Augustus, and he built this colossal temple specifically to honor the Roman emperor. And Herod was not a subtle builder.
Not at all.
To give you a sense of the sheer scale of this propaganda, Dr. Phillips mentions a photograph of one of the stone column bases from this temple. Just the base of one single pillar was as long as his full-grown wife, Elaine, lying down next to it.
Wait, really? A human-sized base for a single pillar?
Just for the base.
That totally shifts the perspective from, like, they built a nice temple to they engineered a massive geopolitical billboard. And they built this temple on the high hill of Samaria using highly polished bright stone. It acted like a beacon. The ancient historian Josephus claimed that sailors coming into the Mediterranean port of Caesarea, which is a full 30 miles away, could look east into the hill country and see the glint of the sun reflecting off Herod's temple.
A 30-mile glare. It was a blinding visual announcement of power, visible from the sea, declaring the dominance of Rome and Herod to anyone even approaching the land.
That's incredible.
It is the perfect culmination of how that open northern topography was utilized for global projection.
Well, it really is an incredible journey we've just taken. We started with farmers meticulously digging limestone rocks out of the red dirt to build crude watchtowers just to protect a year's worth of grapes.
Right.
We navigated the fiercely contested bottleneck of the Benjamin Plateau, where kings were forced into asymmetric warfare just to keep a road open. And we ended up staring at the glittering 30-mile glare of Herod's propaganda temple in the wealthy, exposed north.
It's quite a contrast.
It is. It proved that ancient history wasn't just shaped by great leaders or massive armies. It was fundamentally dictated by the dirt, the rocks, the wadis, and the sheer ridges they had to walk on.
And that brings us right back to our starting point. Trying to comprehend the history of this region without understanding the geography leaves you with an incomplete puzzle. When you know where the mountains physically block movement, where the valleys open up to invaders, and where the resources are hidden, the seemingly chaotic decisions of these ancient kings suddenly make perfect logical sense.
Which leaves me with a final thought for you to ponder. We tend to think of our modern world as completely free from these ancient geographical constraints. I mean, we have airplanes that simply fly over the 3,000-foot mountains, and we have the internet bouncing off satellites in space.
Sure, it feels boundless.
But think about the invisible bottlenecks in our modern infrastructure. Think about the highly specific ocean floor routes where all our global fiber optic cables converge, or the deeply localized semiconductor supply chains that run the entire digital world.
That's a great point.
Are we really that different from King Asa fighting desperately over the crossroads at Ramah? We're the Benjamin Plateaus of the 21st century. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the map and keep exploring.